don't notice that the only features are windswept rock formations, if you ignore the complete absence of any life, and if you don't look at the two distinct suns beside each other in the sky, you could almost forget you weren't on Earth. Almost. Most of my energy is going toward pretending that's the case. Because every time I let myself think about the enormity of what I'm doing, my thoughts start to spiral into a panic. I'm one of only a few dozen people who have ever set foot on this world. Who have ever stood on another planet without a spacesuit, without breathing tubes, with nothing but the suns on my face and a breeze stirring my sweaty hair. I can't pull out my phone and text my sister. I can't ask it for tomorrow's weather. I can't check my feeds to see if anyone's bid on my last salvage finds. There's no spot left on Earth where anyone is ever isolated from anyone else. But I'm alone here. The first people to explore Gaia on foot were trained IA astronauts, prepped over a lifetime of scientific study and practical training. And they died in the temples. I'm just a high school dropout from the Midwest with half a dozen minimum wage jobs under my belt and a juvie rap sheet too dull for the cops to bother with me. And he's even more out of place here than I am. Jules, I say quietly as he finishes his lunch. Listen, are you sure you won't just head back up to the station? No offense, but you stick out here like a... My thoughts screech to a halt. There's no good sentence that starts out with, no offense. I sigh. Well, you stick out. You'll be a target. He's silent for a while, looking first at me and then away, putting his can on the ground and pulling out a fresh white cloth with which to clean off his fingers and lips. Then, softly, he answers, I'm aware of how much I stick out. His eyes flick back toward my face. But I wouldn't be here unless I had to be. I won't just turn and go back. I want so badly to ask why. But then he'll ask me in return why I'm here. And if I know one thing about Jules Thomas already, it's that he wouldn't like my answer to that question. I can only assume the truth hasn't occurred to him yet because we've been on the run for most of our short acquaintance. I draw a breath. Then will you at least let me give you some advice? He nods, folding the napkin and tucking it back into his pack. I'd welcome it, please. How far from your rendezvous point did you get dropped? It was... He pauses, doing a quick mental calculation. A little under 10 kilometers. About 3 hours of walking. See, that's 3 hours to cover 10 Ks. That's too slow. That's why you were late, why your people left without you. I could cover that ground in half that time if I had to. I'm not trying to brag. I'm just... I wave a hand at his pack and the pile of stuff beside it. You're trying to move with an entire outfitter store on your back. You've got to get rid of some of this stuff. Well, the expedition I was joining was going to have gravlifters. He answers, sounding only a little wounded. What am I meant to do? Just leave it all behind? I'm going to need these tools when I reach the temple. When you reach it? I shake my head, willing him to understand. You aren't going to reach it if you keep moving this slowly. And when you do, every raiding party on the planet will have beaten you there. It's a big temple, Jules, but it's not that big. It'll be stripped by the time you get within spitting distance. In my defense, I was anticipating gravlifters, and I was not anticipating such a brutal race between capitalism and academia. Jules's face tightens. Yeah, he really doesn't like raiders. At least I'll be harder to spot on my own. And you never know. I might cross paths with another academically focused expedition, and they'll allow me to join up with them. It'll be a breach of contract with my employer, but surely they'd understand, given the circumstances. I stare at him, heartbeat quickening. Another... Jules, there are no expeditions looking to make new friends or discover the joys of learning. Don't you get that yet? I don't know who scammed you or what fantasy land you're living in, but it's all raiders down here. Scavengers. You don't stuff yourself in a packing crate and get smuggled halfway across the universe to... People don't become criminals for academic whatever. They do it for cash. I became a criminal for academic whatever, Jules says softly, his expression utterly calm, like he's used to listening to abuse without letting it get to him. And you're wrong. I have reason to believe there are other academics here. Hybrid expeditions, combining research with gathering a few select artifacts to justify the expense. Even those artifacts should stay where they are, really. But if we're careful, it's workable. I heard a couple of guys from Yale were... Don't be so naive. A huge part of me hates being so cold. But he's not getting it. And if he doesn't figure it out, he's going to wind up dead. Even if it means he turns that disgust for scavengers on me, he should know what he's up against. Maybe there are some scholars down here, but they're just here to guide the raiding parties. Your expedition was probably just a front for a raider operation, too, and duped you into working with them by promising you whatever they promised you. You don't know everybody's a raider, he insists. Maybe some are like me. Academics, hoping to stop the Philistines from contaminating all the... He trails off, the chill leaving his expression to make way for dawning realization. His gaze meeting mine. Bingo! I've been waiting for him to realize I'm one of them. Those Philistines. No better than the duo whose shoes we stole. I want to speak. But the tiny spark of guilt deep in my mind flares up into an anger I don't want to let out. I'm not going to let some pampered schoolboy make me feel guilty for doing whatever I can to come out of this alive. For doing whatever I have to do to take care of me and mine. You're here to steal from the temples? Jules's voice is quiet, with a note of betrayal in it like we'd been partners. Not just two strangers meeting by chance on the other side of the universe. Do you have any idea? Do you know the damage that does? The ferocity of his voice makes me want to step back. But I hold my ground. We have one chance. One tiny window in which to learn about the race that built these structures. Before they're destroyed. Before all they were is gone. Yes. I clench my jaw for a moment. I don't have to explain myself to him. I don't think he'd understand if I did. Yes, I'm here to steal from the temples. Specifically, the big one where they found that first solar cell. The one that got the scientists all hot and bothered. The one that's single-handedly powering what's left of the West Coast. Think whatever you like about me. But you're a smart guy. And you've got to see that right now, I'm doing better than you are. Will you let me help you or not? He's still staring at me like I've killed his pet dog. That smile gone. His mouth pressed into a thin line. Look, I say, rising to my feet. I'm offering to help. You can refuse on principle and get killed or left to die when you miss your pickup. Trust me, your expedition isn't going to circle back around to pick you up before they split. Or you can let me help you. Then we can go our separate ways. And maybe someday you testify against me in IA court and clear your conscience. He's silent and still, clearly fighting some war against himself. A muscle standing out in his jaw as he gazes at the nearby cliff face. He could be made of the same stone, totally unmoving, wrestling with whatever slowing down his reply. All right, he says finally, as if every word is costing him. Maybe we can help each other. You get me where I want to go, and I'll tell you what artifacts are going to be worth most to the collectors. I take a step back, caught off guard. Hey, I was just offering to tell you how to slim down on your supplies. I'm not taking you anywhere. I've got somewhere to be, and you're just going to slow me down. You're not the only one trying to beat the other raiding parties to the temple. For all I know, they're already there. They're definitely already there. Jules lifts his head, sounding anything but concerned. In fact, some of his anger is retreating and leaving something a lot like smugness in its wake. But fine. Go ahead. Run around the place and grab what scraps you can. Maybe you'll get lucky and stumble across a solar cell everyone else miraculously, inexplicably missed, and make your fortune in a billion-to-one fairy tale ending. Now, if you'd tell me what to leave out of my pack, I'd appreciate it. For all his words are polite, the know-it-all attitude, so charming just a few minutes ago, makes me want to scream. Those scraps are going to save me. Save my sister. Be the difference between life and wishing I were dead. But my voice tangles in my throat. You know what? Never mind. I've lost too much time as it is. Screw you. I grab my pack, shoving its straps into place and reaching for my helmet and goggles. There's nothing there, you know, says Jules, not bothering to get up. I ignore him, buckling the straps of my helmet to my pack and slinging the goggles around my neck. The original astronauts and survey teams brought back everything they could. All you'll find there is an empty tomb full of angry scavengers. I kick my empty can of beans aside and scan the canyon ahead, mapping out my route, trying to figure out if there's any way to make up this lost time and get an edge over the others. His words are ringing in my head, though, with the horrible sting of truth to them. An empty tomb full of angry scavengers. If that's true, it's the end for me. No ticket back to Earth. No payday. No hope for... I swallow. Then Jules adds, as calmly as if he were bidding me a good morning, Amelia, every single one of those groups is looking in the wrong place. The words freeze me, in spite of myself. And after a split second of hesitation, and of kicking myself, I turn back toward him. What did you say? Which part? The question is polite. So polite, I could punch him in his smug little... But he doesn't wait for me to answer and goes on. I said that they're all looking in the wrong place. At the risk of being a little forward with a girl I just met. Bigger isn't always better. A little while ago, his innuendo would have made me laugh. But I can't care about any of that right now. The big temple complex to the east is the one the astronauts started exploring. The one where the Los Angeles solar cell came from. The one Mink and every other scavenger operation is aiming for. But if there aren't any artifacts left in there, or if I'm robbed or captured by another operation, I'll have nothing. I'll be too far in debt with Mink to pay my way off the planet and back through the portal to Earth, much less have enough left over to get to my sister and... I gulp for a breath. How would you know? My voice shakes. The International Alliance has had it under guards for months. That's the whole reason we all had to get dropped off way out here, to avoid the I-8 satellite detection. Jules seems to hear the shake in my voice, and some of the arrogance leaches out of his face. It's a red herring, he says quietly. And there's a bitter note there now without that smugness to hide it. I know the Undying broadcast by heart. The words and equations that brought us all here in its original language. It said the race who found Gaia would be tested. You really think the test is go in this fancy building and pick up our leftovers? Amelia, Oxford's Xena Archaeology Department is world-renowned, and I grew up falling asleep under the table as the world's top experts debated these very subjects. The big temple to the east is, yes, very big, and shiny and attractive. And there might still be a few scraps in there worth some cash. But while humans are hardwired to think bigger is better, there's no reason whatsoever an alien race would think that way as well. And I'm betting my own life on the fact that it's a decoy. Because I've studied the data in that broadcast, and I know which one of the smaller outlying temples holds the real treasure trove. And I can take you there. Now he does get to his feet. His amusement gone, face grave. My heart's thrashing so hard it hurts. Blood rushing in my ears and threatening to deafen me. I have only one shot at this. His distaste is obvious. He's no happier about offering his help to a scavenger and a raider than I am about having to put all my faith in this stranger, whose goals definitely aren't mine. If I trust him and leave the big temple to the others, and it turns out he's lying, I'll have nothing. Even if I survive the next few weeks, I'll come to wish I hadn't when I can't pay my way off, and Mink leaves me here marooned millions of light years from Earth without enough air to last more than a few days. And if I ignore him and get to the complex even a day or two after the other parties, I'll be sifting through the dust they leave behind, trying to cobble together a fortune from broken tablets and scraps of stone. My mouth is dry when my voice returns, and I blurt, "You know I'm one of dozens, right? Plenty of teams figured out how to get here, after the Addison interview." I swallow hard, trying to clear the rasp from my throat. "Misleading me won't do anything to preserve your precious artifacts, because someone else will be there anyway to take them. All you'd be doing is destroying me." Fear floods my voice with that last sentence, my eyes burning. I wish I were wearing my goggles, my breather mask. Maybe then he wouldn't see me fighting not to cry. Jules' expression changes. The tight mouth softening. The brows lifting a little. He takes half a step toward me, but then thinks better of it and stops.
I'm not trying to do that, he says quietly. I'm saying you're right. My only hope is to reach what I'm looking for as quickly as I can.
He takes a breath.
You're going to get a lot farther out here than I will alone. I think we can both agree on that.
But there's a bigger payout, Mia.
The technology the Undying have left behind? It's not in a few solar cells. There's something bigger at play. And to get to it, we have to go deeper. Get to the heart of the temple. My heart is pounding. Now I know this boy's crazy.
What? Past the kinds of traps and pitfalls that took out half the Explorer 4 mission before they gave up?
Jules looks away, one hand coming up to tug through his curls.
He's staring at the cliff again.
I'm offering you a partnership. You help me get there, and...
He breaks off, and I wait. I can see what the words cost him. The way they're nearly dragged from him.
I'll help us get inside the temple. From there, I'll make sure you get your money.
I can hear the disgust behind his voice by the time he finishes speaking. For a wild second, I want to blurt out the truth. That I couldn't care less about money. That money's a means to an end. And that my end is something I'd die for a dozen times over if I thought it'd help. But there's no profit in my death. So I'm risking my life here instead. I take a deep breath, focusing on the air filling my lungs instead of the tears filling my eyes. I was only ever going to be sneaking through the entrances to these temples, picking up what I could, never venturing far enough to trigger the undying defenses they set up to guard their precious legacy, whatever it is. The International Alliance has been trying to put together a proper team to penetrate the temples for years. But when their top expert on the Undying lost his shit on live TV, it kind of put their plans on hold. In a weird way, I have Addison's meltdown. Elliot Addison, the guy who first cracked the Undying broadcast code. The guy who turned a sudden 180 and started claiming that Gaia was dangerous. To thank for being here at all. If he hadn't had that public breakdown and let slip all those top secret codes, none of the illegal scavengers would have known how to get here to Gaia. He must be writhing in his jail cell, knowing that his attempt to prevent exploration of Gaia is what flooded the surface with people like me. Not that we can get very far. Without Addison and his expertise, neither IA led expeditions or scabber operations can get past the temple's myriad defenses. I was only ever supposed to lift artifacts from the entrances. I was only ever supposed to slip in, slip out, and hope I made enough money to satisfy Mink. And now I'm standing here breathing alien air with alien suns beating down on my head. And there's a boy not much older than me claiming he can do what the whole global scientific community hasn't managed yet and solve a zillion-year-old alien mystery if I help keep him alive long enough to do it. And whether he's right or not, I've lost too much time now to get to the bigger temple before others strip it. Fine, I say, firming up my voice. But I can't guarantee you a ride off the ground. I can get you to someone who can do it, but you'll have to pay your own way. Make your own deal with her.
Understood. He agrees. Businesslike again. Smoothing away his distaste at working with a scavenger. When does she come for you?
3 weeks.
Assuming I have the money, of course, to pay her. If I don't, she won't bother sending a shuttle down for me at all. But I don't share that with Jules. He must know I'm not telling him everything. But for now, he doesn't press for more information. He studies my face until I feel it start to warm, making me long to pull my goggles and kerchief into place. Then he nods. In that case, we should get moving.
Chapter 4. Jules. I watch helplessly as she discards more than half my belongings. The organization that recruited me supplied my breather and a few other necessities, but I spent more than I'd care to admit on the rest of it. This equipment she's tossing aside like it's worthless. I had to buy it all new, because I couldn't access most of my belongings at home. She's obsessed with the idea that everything must serve more than one function. She brandishes her own tool, like one of those old Swiss Army knives people used to carry, as if it's worth more than my wave stove. I want to tell her that you can order one exactly like it for 20 quid online, but when she mentions having made a number of alterations to it herself and demonstrates its spring-loaded settings, I have to admit it's clever. And this is why I need her. Without the relative luxury of a whole expedition to back me, I don't know how I'm going to make it to the temple intact when I know next to nothing about this underworld that she's a part of, this network of raiders and thieves. Back home, these are the kinds of people who start looting stores and hospitals the second a city's people are forced to abandon it. It's worst in the U.S., according to the news. They're seeing the most drastic climate changes, with deserts sweeping across the continent and sandstorms violent enough to claim lives. Families get packed up and carted elsewhere once the city shuts down, and their sofas aren't even cold before these scavenger gangs move in and start divvying up what's left. The thought of working with one of them makes me sick to my stomach, but at least she's only one, and not a whole gang, and at least she's not really what I expected, I suppose. She seems to take particular relish in lecturing me on the ways my gear is redundant. Any item of mine that can't justify its existence in half a dozen ways is stashed in a shallow cave, there to stay until the end of time, I suppose. Or until the next spacefaring civilization comes through, following the same trail we did. Still, once we start walking, I'm grateful for the lighter load. We have several hours of daylight left, and we ought to dispose of quite some distance before we camp for the night. The two suns bear down overhead, and without trees for shade, it's hot. It's hard to wrap my head around the idea that I'm genuinely walking on another planet. And I occasionally push at the idea, worrying at it like a loose tooth, trying to provoke a response. We thought we were done with our chance at this, when the Alpha Centauri colony mission failed, calling out to Earth for help that they knew couldn't come, then vanishing forever into the blackness of space. But here I am, Jules Thomas Addison, literally going where no one has gone before. And I'm lying to the one ally I have. It's not bragging or exaggeration to say that right now I'm the most important person on this planet. I have to reach that temple. Not just for me, not just for my father, but for all of us, every person on Earth, including Amelia. That's justification enough for the lie. And odds are there will be something of value there she can take, so it probably isn't even a lie. It's justification enough for teaming up with the Scaver, and I've promised myself that I will find her a way to earn her money, however distasteful looting is. I was prepared to do it to a small degree for Global Energy to earn my ride here. Helping her is no different. But it's hard to reconcile this girl with what she's here to do. It's easier to hate vultures and carrion scavengers when they're not standing in front of you with freckles and dye-streaked hair and a razor-sharp wit. But then again, I'd like to think I'm a fundamentally honest person, and I'm in the middle of lying to her about what we'll find when we reach our destination. She's made it clear she's here to make money, and I need to remember she'd walk away from me in a heartbeat if she thought there was a better profit in it. Which means that I need to be prepared to tell her whatever will keep her by my side. If we're not moving at the speed I'd hoped for in a larger group, equipped with vehicles, it's better than nothing. We should be at the temple I'm after in under a week, traveling on foot. We're heading for a long, winding canyon, a landmark I memorized from the endless swathes of satellite images that used to litter my father's study back at Oxford. If we're lucky, it should provide us with a highway that will take us most of the way to our destination. It has a stream running the better part of its length, which will take care of our water needs as well. The only problem is that for a while, at least, it's the same path all the other groups will be following. The canyon branches in a number of places, and eventually we'll be taking a different branch. But until we do, we've got to keep our profile as low and quiet as we can, to avoid attracting attention from scavengers, who'd be just as happy to raid our packs as the temples themselves, and perhaps remove a little competition at the same time. My father would be horrified. Dr. Elliot Addison used to be the last word on the Undying. There was no one more dedicated to unraveling their secrets, no one more passionate about learning from them. But the International Alliance, haunted by their decades-old promise to find a solution to Earth's decline, accused him of wasting time. And the harder they pushed, the more my father began to resist. When the Explorer 4 crew entered that main temple, without my father's guidance, he raged for a week. And that was when he began fighting, trying to make them understand, making passionate pleas to the IA authorities and the public alike, that some of mankind's most important, practical discoveries came out of pure research, that the time spent to truly explore Gaia would be anything but wasted, that more power cells would certainly help now, but only until we outgrew those like we outgrew our oil reserves. He desperately believed that the key to our salvation lay in understanding the Undying, in understanding why they destroyed themselves after reaching such heights in their civilization. Their warnings, my father said, were to stop us doing exactly what the International Alliance would have us do. Rush in, take as much profitable and useful technology as we could carry, and start shoving it anywhere it'd fit in Earth's infrastructure. He wanted us to take our time, to focus on the science, to let ourselves be drawn on by exploration, curiosity and discovery, instead of driven by greed. He was ridiculed for his insistence that we needed to open our minds, to explore this place with the thoughtfulness and reverence and caution it deserved, not run so hungrily for the one benefit we could see that we missed others, or missed dangers. They used to come to our flat in Oxford, the suits from the International Alliance, and I put my ear to the door of his office while they argued with my father for hours. My father wanted to learn about Gaia and the Undying as badly as they did, wanted to help those who needed it as badly as they did, and he tried longer than most scientists would have to find alternate explanations for the dangers and inconsistencies he was finding in the broadcast. First, they came to debate him, then to argue with him, then to plead with him to change his position. Pleading turned to cajoling, turned to peer exile, turned to threats. But he never seemed to falter. I didn't realize he'd stopped trying to convince the world until after he snapped on live television. I'm not sure he even knew he was going to commit treason that night until it was happening. But halfway through the program, the interviewer abandoned the usual, courteous dance, and pushed and baited him, started accusing him of sacrificing the welfare of others, people like Mia, who desperately need the IA to solve Earth's energy problems, merely to satisfy his own academic curiosity. And I saw the moment he broke. A few security clearance codes blurted in frustration and anger. He already knew at that point they were going to drag him away, I'm sure of it. And in seconds, hundreds of logins around the world had downloaded every document the IA had kept classified about Gaia, the temples, and the undying tech. He meant to give the world transparency. Instead, he handed them the keys to pillaging this planet. I remember the moment he met my eyes, as they held me back and dragged him out of the studio after shutting down his interview. I haven't met his eyes since, except through a vidscreen once a week. He sacrificed everything, from his reputation to his happiness to his future, to my future for his cause. And I have too, because I believe he's right. I trust him. My father is certain that we need to enter Gaia slowly, carefully, recognizing that the true wealth of these ruins lies in scientific study and understanding. And yet here we all are, charging on in like shoppers at a holiday sale, looking for the shiniest baubles to bring home. Nobody is supposed to be on the surface at present. The space station in orbit is tasked with enforcing that ban and conducting satellite surveillance to continue building the maps and surveys the IA's expedition will use when trying to solve the riddle of the undying temples. Of course, as I discovered through my contact at Global Energy, for the right price, the staff on the station won't just look the other way. They'll even get you down to the surface. Thanks to what my father said on a live broadcast, it's not just the International Alliance that knows how to reach Gaia now. It must have been quite an investment for Amelia to get down here on her own. I'm about to ask her whether she raised the money herself or has backers, when she stops at the crest of a hill, dropping to a crouch with a low curse. I thump down beside her, easing forward to prop up on my elbows, and peer over the ridge to see what stopped her in her tracks. The creek we were aiming for is a silvery line stretching along the Red Valley, looking strangely barren without plants taking advantage of the water. My eyes are used to Earth in ways I didn't even realize until I landed here. But it's not the lack of plant life that makes Mia groan at my side. Camped all along one side of the river is a sizable expedition that's paused for their evening meal, crates and grav lifters visible, and a row of skimmer bikes. For a brief moment, I think maybe it's the expedition I was meant to join, and my heart lifts. But then I recognize the woman from our little encounter by the spring. Raiders. I count at least four people moving back and forth between their possessions. They'll have visibility for the length of the canyon. Perfect tutti. There goes our plan. So, I say, gazing down at them. Head on down and introduce ourselves, yes? Amelia lets out a snort, then taps her goggles to activate their Zoom setting. Wait here, Oxford, okay? I got this. Apparently that's all the warning I'm getting, before she starts to clamber down into the canyon without further consultation. I grab hold of her pack, and after a couple of tugs she realizes she's not going anywhere until I let go. What? Well, I suppose most pressingly, where are you going? I venture, still holding on. She eyeballs me, disapproving of this new streak of curiosity. I'm going to steal one of those bikes, she says, in the same nonchalant tone with which she might say, I'm going to go for a nice stroll. I tighten my grip as I turn that one over in my mind. How am I meant to work with this kind of impulsiveness? I was kidding when I said it, but was she really just going to saunter on down there and hope it all unfolded according to plan, assuming she even has a plan? When she tugs against my grip, I return to the question of the bike. On one hand, it would be enormously risky to try to steal one. On the other, a skimmer bike could cut our travel from a whole week to less than a day. And, a tiny voice says in my mind, if they catch her, she's one of them anyway, isn't she? What's the worst that could happen to her? The fact that I just asked myself that makes me a little bit sick. But I have to remember that what I'm here to do is more important than me, than her, or than any individual. And I have to remember that she's a scaver, and I have no way of knowing if she's even interested in returning loyalty, let alone capable of it. The skimmer would get us there in less than a day. Also, if there's one thing I've worked out about Amelia already, it's that there's very little point arguing with her once she's made up her mind. Then let me help, I say instead. Your safety is my safety now. She eyeballs me again, and I wait out her disapproval until she adjusts her goggles with a muttered opinion that she chooses to keep under her breath. Stay close. If they spot us, make for the ridge to the east. It's too rocky for skimmer bikes, so at least it'll be a foot race. Yes, ma'am, I say, just to provoke that little line between her eyes that shows up when she glares at me. I need to stop noticing that. Though we've got to move slowly to avoid triggering any major rock slides down the canyon walls, the breeze running through the valley masks our smaller movements. So really, it's just a case of patience. Sweat runs into the small cuts on my hands and face, and my back aches steadily. But Amelia moves without complaint, and I'm not going to give her another reason to think twice about agreeing to partner up. This skimmer bike idea alone has proved that I was right to recruit her help. I'd have carefully avoided this group and spent another week making my way to the temple. Presumably because there are only a few dozen people on the planet, the camp doesn't have any guards posted. I see a lean man with dark hair sprawled on the grass, eating, talking to the woman Mia decked with her helmet by the spring where we met. That means our other friend must be somewhere nearby too, with or without his trousers. It's not a huge coincidence that it's the same group, given how difficult it is just to get to Gaia's surface, but my stomach tightens. Until we peel away from the main route along the canyon, heading to my smaller target, we're going to be up close and personal with these other groups, groups that clearly have no qualms about shooting the competition. I think about the scavenger's gun tucked into my bag, one of the few pieces of equipment Amelia put into the keep pile without discussion. Even if I'd thought to make it accessible before crawling into danger, though, I'm not sure I could really point it at someone with the intent to pull the trigger. I'm rather regretting my impulsive order to that big guy to leave his trousers behind. Perhaps under other circumstances, they might have held off on shooting, afraid of ruining their skimmer. But I have a feeling he won't hesitate to aim straight at us. A couple of the other raiders are filling their canteens at the spring, and one standing some distance away, face lit by the screen of his phone or tablet as he hunches over it. Most important for us, nobody's paying attention to the row of skimmers. The lack of order also means there's no discernible pattern to their movements, though we watch for a little as Amelia taps her finger softly against a pebble. She's counting the seconds, I realize, looking for the best gap. She's not holding her stolen gun either, but I'm betting hers is in a pocket somewhere she can reach it if she has to. I ease my knife out of my own pocket. Happily, it has several extra tools built into the handle, so I was permitted to keep it. All hell's going to break loose when we make off with one of their bikes, but I think I know how to slow down their pursuit. I'm jolted from my planning when Amelia tilts her head at me and, crouching low, heads toward the bikes. My height means I'm a liability, but I can at least keep up, even if I can't crouch as low. Amelia drops to one knee to work on the ignition of her chosen skimmer, and I drop down beside her, crawling along the road to the farthest bike. Time to see if all those hours of putting up with my cousin Neil's obsession with his bike were worth it. Time to see if I can remember how to find the power cables. I check the casing with one finger to make sure it's not still hot, then reach up inside to grope around blindly, sending up a silent prayer of thanks as my fingers close over the nest of cords. Heart thumping, hands sweating, I yank the knife through them, severing the connections, then crawl down to the next one. A shower of sand hits the back of my neck as I reach the third, and my heart surges up into my throat. I jerk around to find Amelia silently shooting me a what-the-hell look. But there's no way to explain what I'm doing without speaking, so I immobilize the final bike and start crawling back to her side. Once I'm close enough, I drop my head to whisper into her ear.
Nobody's going to chase us now.
She's silent for an instant. Then a huff of air hints at the laughter neither of us can risk. I feel myself wanting to laugh too. Some combination of adrenaline and terror and utterly mad abandon. My mind is shrieking that this isn't me, that I belong back at Oxford, that this girl and her insane ideas are going to get me killed, that I'm no daredevil, and my best bet would be to stay put and call back up to the station when it's back overhead. And yet I feel myself wanting to laugh, because there's some part of this that's fun. It turns out she's using an ancient paperclip to short out the thumbprint scanner, and with a satisfying hiss, it gives up the ghost. She winks, then rises to her feet to swing one leg over the bike. She shifts her pack around to her front to make room for me to slide on behind her. I'm momentarily stuck on where to put my hands. Wrapping them around her waist seems overly familiar, when a voice rings out behind us and steps approach.
Raza said to leave the skimmers there.
The owner of the voice has clearly mistaken us for members of his gang, and every nerve in my body lights up as adrenaline goes crashing through me.
Oh, perfect tutti, we're screwed. Where did he come from?
She wants to make sure they're sheltered if the wind...
And then the voice rises abruptly to a shout.
Hey! Who?
I end my debate and throw my arms around Amelia, and she jams her thumb into the ignition. The bike hums to life, lifting up off the sand to about knee height, and as she turns her head to look back at the bike's old owner, her smile's pure mischief.
Thanks for the ride!
Then we're accelerating away, gathering speed rapidly as she weaves her way through the boulders, making for level ground. I've only been on the back of Neil's bike a couple of times, but I know enough to lean when it turns, and as the wind rushes past us, I'm resisting the urge to tip my head back and shout our victory. Then the rocks to our right explode into flying bits of gravel that strike my back like shrapnel. I twist my head to see the scavengers lining the edge of their camp, aiming their weapons after us. Explosive ammunition. Amelia's curse is whipped away by the wind, and she accelerates so fast that she risks a spectacular crash as bullets fly past us. And abruptly, the world snaps into focus.
What the hell am I doing? This isn't a game. This is my life. And if one of those things so much as grazes us, I won't live long enough to feel it.
I'll be dead on an alien planet, and nobody at home will ever know what happened to me. My heart surges up through my throat, and every movement, every sound is turned up high. My whole body is pins and needles, twitching in anticipation of a bullet right between my shoulder blades. This isn't a game, and I'm way, way out of my depth.
I shouldn't be here.
The skimmer tips at a crazy angle with no warning, and I tighten my arms around Amelia while desperately trying to make sense of the world as it flies past. We're careening down the side of a canyon, and for three terrifying heartbeats, it seems as though there's no way we can stop. We're going to cartwheel end over end to lie broken at the bottom until they come for us. Then the bike levels out, and Amelia's thumping on my forearm with one fist to get me to loosen my grip. When I remember how to make my arms work and do so, she takes a long, shuddering breath. We're racing along the bottom of the canyon, taking the twists and turns like we have nothing to lose, and though I crane my neck to look behind us, I have no way of knowing if they're following. Then the canyon fork looms up as we take another curve, And somehow, through my streaming eyes and lurching stomach, I realize how much ground we've covered.
"Take the left fork!"
I scream, to be heard over the roar of the wind and the engine.
"What?"
Mia's voice is half torn away by the wind.
"But the temples!"
"Trust me!"
I give her a squeeze, the only way I have to emphasize my words. She hesitates a moment longer, then says something in reply that I'm glad I can't decipher over the wind. She throws her weight to the left, and the bike goes lurching down the narrower canyon path, away from the soon-to-be well-traveled path to the central temple. Sometime later, she abruptly skids over to the side and cuts the engine, the sound echoing off the canyon walls, then dying away. The skimmer thuds down onto the ground, the jolt traveling all the way up my spine. We both hold perfectly still, her thumb hovering over the ignition, straining our ears for the sound of pursuit. There's nothing but silence. The walls of the canyon stretch up above us, lips tilting in to obscure most of the afternoon sky, and it seems we're hidden.
"Are we dead?"
I whisper, breath still coming in short, sharp gasps, my body still a bundle of nerves.
"Don't think so,"
she whispers back.
"They tried pretty hard, though. You're sure this is the way?"
"Positive," I reply, trying to make myself sound certain, because I am certain I'm going the right way. Just not so certain that it's the way she'd choose if she had all the facts.
"Then let's get a little more distance."
She starts up the skimmer again, taking the corners with only a little more caution as we race away down the canyon. My insides are churning, and I'm pretty sure my stomach's trying to climb up my throat to join my heart there, and the things I'm repeating to myself like a litany aren't making much difference at all.
"They're not following us," I tell myself. "We made it. We'll get to the temple faster. This was a good idea."
I'm clenching and unclenching my fists, as if by sheer physical force I can make these things true, despite the one thought that keeps ringing around and around in my head. I'm not just out of my depth. I'm realizing I don't even know how to swim. I can't imagine my father's face, if they even bothered to tell him about my death. They might think it would compromise their chance of getting him to start cooperating again. I can't imagine my cousin Neil's or my mother's, though there's a lot I can't imagine about her lately. I shove all of it out of my mind. We're closer to the temple than we were before, closer to its spiral shape and stone curves, and the answers I hope to find there. Finally, Amelia pulls over, parking the skimmer behind a boulder and turning it off once more. It crunches down to the ground, and we both climb off. My hands are shaking. I clear my throat before I speak, hoping at least my voice will be level.
"That was good driving."
"It's easy here," she replies, shrugging away the compliment. "I'm used to much tighter quarters. Skid on some loose gravel here, you're in trouble. Crash into a skyscraper on Earth, and you're done. Let's take a few minutes, stretch, use our breathers, then keep moving. Even if they repair their bikes, they've got no way of finding us now, and we'll hear them coming if they get close."
I try for normal conversation, stretching my back, willing my arms and legs to start working properly, as my system tries to process the shock of what's happened.
"Where did you learn to ride like that?"
"Chicago."
She glances at me, sees that isn't answer enough, and shakes her head.
"You wouldn't want to know."
And, of course, immediately I do. It's a distraction, and I need to do more than stretch my arms and legs to get myself back to rights.
"Why not?"
I unhook my breather from my belt and take a long drag of oxygen-rich air from its attached tank. The oxygen in the tank goes a long way, just a little added to the air I'm drawing in naturally, but that extra percent or two makes a real difference. Because it'll give you all the more reason to think I'm a terrible person, she replies, not sounding particularly guilty about it. I've committed just as much crime today as you have, I point out.
True,
she allows. But look on the bright side. Grand Theft Skimmer Bike isn't as bad as breaking International Alliance planetary embargoes. You're clearly on the path back toward the light. You're right. I'm de-escalating. I'll be reformed in no time. You're a good influence. She laughs for that, shaking her head.
You're unexpected, Oxford.
I'm reaching for the last vestiges of composure, I admit. Please tell me that terrified you half as much as it terrified me.
It did.
She eases off her pack and leans back against the canyon wall, soaking up the heat from the sun-warmed rock, folding her arms around her midsection to hug herself.
The reason I've lived so long is that I avoid people like that. I thought they were going to hit us.
I'm glad we stole that guy's trousers this morning, I say. I'm pretty sure I need a new pair. That startles a proper laugh out of her, and the noise thaws something inside me a little. We could have been shot, but we weren't. If you won't tell me how you learned to drive, tell me something else about yourself. I try, just to see if I can keep her talking, let my nerves settle, and keep her from asking any questions about me, because I'm not sure my poker face is any good right now. She considers the question for a minute or so before she replies.
When I was little, she says eventually, I wanted to be an astronomer when I grew up.
Which isn't quite the same thing as telling me something about herself now, but actually, I take that back. She's clearly not an astronomer, so in a way I do know something about her. How things turned out for her. I want to ask what happened to get in the way of that dream, but I bury the question for the present. When I was small, I wanted to be an airplane. The embarrassment is worth it for her quick snort of laughter, even if it's probably half-fueled by adrenaline from our heist and ensuing escape.
There was logic behind it, I protest. I wanted to fly, but birds seemed very fragile. My father tried to explain it wasn't feasible, but I kept pointing out every new cybernetic upgrade that came along. I was completely confident they'd have the plane question sorted by the time I grew up, which would, of course, be far, far into the future. My father said I might see some drawbacks to being a plane by adulthood, though, and turns out he was right.
I don't know.
She's still grinning, and the sight of it warms my core a little more, almost banishing the pang I feel at the mention of my father, almost banishing the fear that's still pulsing through me.
Being an airplane sounds pretty good to me. For a start, you'd have a way to get off the ground, instead of being stuck here. Better the pilot, or the shuttle, I guess, than the cargo.
The image of the portal between Earth and Gaia comes back to me for a moment. My backer's representative, Charlotte, somehow got me formal International Alliance identification, albeit in the name of François Larue, and I posed as a junior technician, being posted to the orbital station around Gaia. I pretended to speak nothing but French, which helped avoid most conversation during transit. The view on the way here was pretty spectacular, I admit. The portal itself, the way it shimmered, you know? Even if the jump through it was disconcertingly like being stretched.
No,
she replies, grimacing.
I don't know. I spent my trip stuffed in a packing crate.
Her tone does not invite more conversation on the subject of our trip here, and I move along quickly.
Well, I haven't entirely ruled the plane option out, I say.
If this life of crime continues, and I become some sort of evil mastermind, I'll certainly have the funds. I'll take you for a ride. And then, almost as much to convince myself as to comfort her,
I don't think you're a terrible person, Mia. You think what I do is terrible,
she replies, looking away finally to locate her own breather mask.
Same thing, really, for you.
And that shuts